tonight on Arena. We look forward to the Coorch International Festival of Literature with writers Nuala O'Connor, Viet Thanh Nguyen and Carmen Maria Machado. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Next Thursday, the Coorch International Festival of Literature opens. This year, the festival is not coming live from Galway, but it's gone online. However, the roster of writers and other artists is as impressive as ever. Tonight on Arena, we're thrilled to be hosting three of the world-class writers on offer at the Coorch event. Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Sympathiser and now its sequel, The Committed, Viet Thanh Nguyen. Short story writer and essayist, Carmen Maria Machado will speak to us about her memoir In the Dream House. And the third writer and our first guest this evening is the author Nuala O'Connor, who has just published her fifth novel to critical acclaim, Nora, a reimagining of the life of Nora Barnacle, life partner, soulmate and muse of James Joyce and the inspiration of numerous of his literary characters. And delighted to have Nuala join us now to discuss the book. I'm just looking there, Nuala. You moved to Galway 25 years ago. So are you still a blow-in in Galway, or are you now qualified as a Galwegian to write about one of the great Galwegians, Nora Barnacle?
I don't know if I'm qualified, but certainly I've been let in to an extent because somebody wrote about me in the paper last week, Galway native Nuala O'Connor. So I feel like I've arrived.
No longer a blow-in. But your interest in Nora Barnacle, I think, precedes your move to the City of Tribes.
Yeah, Brendan Maddox's gorgeous biography of Nora, which is called Nora, The Real Life of Molly Bloom, came out when I was a teenager in the 80s. And I read it, fascinated. And then, of course, Pat Murphy's beautiful film that she made with Jerry Stenbridge et al. Came out a few years after that with Susan Lynch as a magnificent Nora. And, you know, always I've been aware of her as a strong and interesting and courageous Galway woman who was life partner and muse to James Joyce. And I, you know, knew that coming here. And then every Bloomsday, the Nora Barnacle Museum in Bowling Green would host an event that I would go to, and we'd read passages from Ulysses and what have you, and, you know, have a few drinks, and it was gorgeous. So I was studying Italian actually by night in NUI Galway when I got the idea to write about Nora. I was writing an essay about Jim and his friendship with the Italian writer Italo Svevo, and I just found when I was doing the research, I couldn't stop going off on these Nora tangents. So I, you know, that's always a good sign with me in terms of my interest is piqued. I'm getting kind of excited. It's almost like falling in love. So I just, I did what I often do. I wrote a short story to whet my appetite, maybe. Well, I thought it was a thing in and of itself, which it was. And it did well. It was published in Granta and it won a prize. But I couldn't. My communion with Nora was certainly not over. I did not want to let her go. I was enjoying her voice. I was curious to travel with them to Trieste and beyond. And so I kept going. And, you know, it's almost, as I said, like the start of a love affair. And what a glorious one to immerse yourself in, because the research is just vast and interesting, you know.
Can we hear the opening of the book, in fact, because you mention Nora's voice, and this struck me from the very outset of the book. And there's a little bit of language here, a kind of Joycean type of feel to it, with a toilet feel to it at times as well. So, and it's set, it's very important that this is set, this first chapter, on June 16th, 1904, very important day in the world of Joyce.
That's right, because it was immortalised as Bloom's Day, of course, by Joyce in Ulysses. They met on the 10th of June, but this is their first date walkout. So this is it. We walk along by the Liffey as far as Ringsend. The river smells like a piss pot, spilling its muck to the sea. We stop by a wall, Jim in his sailor's cap looking like a Swede, me in my wide-brimmed straw trying to throw the provinces off me. Out there are the Muglands Rocks, Jim says, pointing out to sea. They have the shape of a woman lying on her back. His look to me is sly to see if I've taken his meaning. I have. And our two mouths crash together and it's all swollen tongues and drippy spit and our fronts pressed hard and a tight bunched feeling between my legs. His hands travel over my bodice and squeeze, making me gasp. Old Jim is all I can manage to say, and I step away from him. You have no natural shame, Nora, he says. And he's coming at me now with his thing out of his trousers and in his hand, that one-eyed manine he's no doubt very fond of. It looks, I think, like a plum dressed in a snug coat. No natural shame, I say. Don't be annoying me. Do you think because I'm a woman that I should feel nothing, want nothing, know nothing? But I dip my nose to his neck for a second, the better to breathe his stale porter, lemon soap smell, span new to me. Jim squints and smiles. I kneel on the ground before him, my face before his tender manine, and glance up at him. So that's them.
That's where you're stopping, fair
no,
enough.
Okay. No, that's... the rest of that is not fit for radio now.
Well, isn't that the thing? That's Neil O'Connor reading the opening page, more or less, of her novel Nora, all about the love story of Nora Barnacle and James Joyce. But it is, several of the aspects of the book are present in that first page, not least of which is sex. Food isn't present there, but it will be present quite a lot, and there'll be a few dirty letters present as well. Those are the three essential elements for any book about Joyce. Are they essential for any book about Nora Barnacle?
Yeah. I mean, also, you know, I suppose the biggest piece at the heart of it is the family story. Like, it's not just a love story of two people, it's of four people. They loved their children unconditionally. You know, but yeah, those things, like, they were rarely parted. They were a very tight little unit, the four of them, a little quartet, with much love and sort of interesting humour and language between them. They spoke Italian at home because they lived in Trieste when the children were born. And even though it was part of Austria-Hungary at the time, they spoke Italian at home because it was an Italian city as such. And then when they were parted in 1909, Joyce came back to Dublin to set up a cinema. Then began the erotic letters that the two wrote to each other. Now, Nora's part of the correspondence is missing, presumed lost or destroyed, we don't know. But Jim's are extant, as we know, when they were first published in 1975. So because they were so recently published, I decided to make versions of them for the novel rather than use the real thing as such. So I wrote very closely mimicking what he said, the letters to Nora, and then I wrote hers back as a sort of a, I used his like as a kind of a call and response guide. So when he would praise her for using certain phrases or, you know, saying different things, I would have her say them in her letters. Yeah,
so it kind of made, you were echoing what he said, she had said in some ways was what you're, what you do in the invention of the letters. But I again, I'm really taken by the opening line of the novel and the fact that it has that Joycean feel to it, referring to the river and the smell of the river, so visceral, so guttural, and so, you know, very much earthy, rooted in the earth, not literary in any sense. But it struck me, and you mentioned this at different points in the novel, about Joyce speaks to, or Jim, as he is in the book, speaks to Nora, or Goosine, as she is in the book. He speaks to her and constantly refers to wanting to hear her voice, wanting to hear her speak. To what extent do you think Nora's Galway upbringing, her maybe less, not quite high-flown education, but a more basic education, her input into Joyce's work was very much on the oral side of language?
Absolutely. I mean, when he first met her, he was drawn to her for her sort of dignified looks. She was very attractive, had beautiful auburn hair, but he must have been thrilled skinny when she opened her mouth and started to speak, because she had a very sort of a natural, she had a natural good humour, but she was also very sincere and loved to talk and tell a story. And they both loved music, of course. So she had this kind of good-hearted, good-humoured, naturally sort of good-humoured person. But he saw huge nobility in her and was fascinated by her stories and would have her tell them and retell them, you know, as fodder for his own work. But one time he wrote to her, actually in 1909, during the erotic letters period, everything that's noble and exalted and deep and true and moving in what I write comes, I believe, from you. This is what he said to her. You are more to me than the world. So this wasn't any meeting of unequal people. This was a meeting of equals in so many ways. He had the ability to write the stuff down. He had been gifted an education. He was from well, as we know, the fallen genteel, a middle class family. Mm. She'd been educated like most people until the age of 12. But she had a love of song and play acting. She used to dress as a boy and wander around Galway with her friend, trying to fool her uncle and, you know, this kind of stuff. She had a kind of a play acting personality as well, and could tell a story, had a great mouthful of stories. And he said as well, again in a letter, that if I'm to write anything fine or noble, I'll do it by listening at the doors of your heart. You know, so he was very aware of what she gave to him. Other people didn't seem to be as much aware until they got to know her. And then, you know, one of their friends in Paris, Arthur Power, said that she brought a breath of Galway air into the intellectual hothouse of Paris, which I thought was a gorgeous way to put it, and very apt.
Yeah, because she is well able to hold her own, as you show us in the book, in high society, when he does become, they have a difficult time and a life of living literally a hand-to-mouth existence for large parts of it. But when Joyce is recognised, and when money is coming in, and when they are being feted by high society, particularly in Paris, later on in their lives, she fits into that society with total and absolute ease.
Yeah, I think it's because she was a naturally hospitable person. She was well able to invite people into their home. She loved to put on a good spread of food. And Joyce, of course, wrote about that in The Dead, the whole notion of Irish hospitality. You know, she had a kind of a bright disposition, and somebody else, I'm not sure if Herbert Gorman was a biographer or just a friend, but he said she brought a roguish Irish humour that was delightful. That's what he said. You know, she sort of was the levity in the room, because Joyce was, you know, he was serious about the work, and he also found people a little bit tricky. You know, he wasn't naturally gregarious. Mm. Drink made him gregarious, but he wasn't naturally that way. So she was a great one to invite people in and have a bit of, you know, fun. And then once he was drinking, he was off himself.
And this idea of her being the inspiration, I mean, I think it's very much there, as I said to you, and as you agreed, I think, in the oral language and the way that Joyce wrote in such a needed to be read out loud type of way. But this idea, I suppose, Molly Bloom is the obvious character, given the sexual relationship that you describe very vividly in the book, a very equal sexual relationship between the pair of them, an equal desire. Molly Bloom is the obvious parallel to draw in terms of characters. Are there others in your mind?
I suppose there's Bertha in Exiles. I think she was very closely based on Nora. You know, even young Greta in Ulysses as well, not Greta Gertie, and then definitely Greta in The Dead. You know, Joyce didn't let any crumb pass. You know, if anything interested him, he jotted it down. He was a great note taker and noticer, as most writers are, of things that were going on around him. And he very actively mined people, including Nora, for their stories and their information. You know, I don't think he made any secret of the fact that he wanted people's stories in order to use them. That's what writers do. Some of us are maybe a little more secretive about it, but he was quite, you know, upfront about it, I think. And I'm sure she was flattered. She wasn't mad about Ulysses. She called Molly, that fat Molly Bloom. She wasn't crazy about her. Mm. She did love Finnegan's Wake. She said, now, there's a book. And he bought her an aquamarine ring to represent the river in it. You know, they'd all this lovely sort of... there was a lovely generosity about them when they had money. It was a real case of share the wealth, which I think is a very Irish thing as well. People, you know, sharing with each other, and they love to adorn each other as well with beautiful things.
Joyce was possessive, and certainly in many of the scenes you give us in the book, he's very jealous. And she had her fair share of admirers. Not least of whom, it seems she loved Stanislav, the brother who lived with them for large amounts of time in Europe. They were all there trying to make a few bob to support the family in many ways. So Stanny was there, the brother was there for quite a while. His love for Nora, I think, had perhaps elements to it that were more than just brother-in-law, sister-in-law. And there's also another fella you mentioned in the book, and there are plenty of them, but the one that stuck out to me in particular was Signor Prezioso. This is Roberto Prezioso, who refers to Nora as, Irlandina, which is an absolutely beautiful way to describe her.
Yeah.
But despite all of those suitors, she is faithful, totally and absolutely faithful to the end.
Yeah, that's what I picked up. I mean, he shoved her towards Prezioso. He encouraged her to invite Prezioso to the house and to be with him alone. Joyce was a great man for Flurry. He wanted events, you know. What did Stanley say? He lives on the excitement of events. He wanted things to happen so he'd have things to write about. And maybe the moving around and the drinking with sailors was all to do with that, creating fodder to write about. His own dalliances, for example, with Martha Fleischmann in Zurich and that. But he definitely shoved Nora towards people. Like, she opened her heart to Frank Budgeon at one point. I think the scene got cut from my novel in the end. But, you know, she says, oh, he wants me to go with other men. And she burst into tears. This actually happened in Zurich. And Budgeon's trying to comfort her and he's appalled. But then he facilitates Joyce to be with Fleischmann. So there's all this mad stuff happening in the background. Yeah. he needed sort of untoward events in order to create things to write about he ran out of Dublin.
Well, listen, lovely to speak to you. Congrats on the novel. So much more in it. We've just skimmed the surface of it, but you will be talking about it as part of Coorch. Your event is on the 23rd, isn't it, on Friday at 5:30 p.m. Available on YouTube. It's a pay what you can, as most of the events are at this year's Coorch. But I thought we might finish up with The Lass of Ockram, Lisa O'Neill version. It's a hugely important song in the Joycean canon, isn't it, Nuala?
That's right. It's Jim referred to it as your song when he wrote to her from her mother's house in Bowling Green, and he had Nora's mother sing the song to him. It's an absolute beauty.
This is Lisa O'Neill's version. Thanks for speaking to us this evening, Nuala.
Thank you.
My next guest, Viet Thanh Nguyen, is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Sympathizer, the story of a communist spy living among Vietnamese exiles in America. The Committed is a sequel to The Sympathizer, and this time round, the narrator, having returned to Vietnam where he was persecuted for being an anti-communist spy, now finds himself a refugee in Paris. Delighted that Viet Thanh Nguyen joins us this morning for you, Viet, this evening for us here in Ireland. Why did you send your unnamed... Well, he kind of is named this time round. He's named Vaudan, but we'll come back to that. Why did you send him off to Paris this time round?
Well, hey, Sean, it's such a pleasure to be here. Well, you know, he's part French and part Vietnamese. His father is a French priest who molested this young girl who became our sympathizer's mother. And in the first novel, The Sympathizer, I thought that the French kind of got off easy. I mean, the focus of that book was on the American war in Vietnam, and so I had a lot to say about the Americans and the Vietnamese of all sides, and a little bit to say about the French. And so in the sequel, The Committed, I thought it would just be appropriate for me to try to offend the French, to criticize them for what they did under French colonialism in Indochina, what they called Indochina. Which, you know, I think the French have sort of gotten away with it. The Americans have left behind a visual record of what they did. We get to see this in photographs and in Hollywood movies and all of this. So whether or not we know anything about the American war in Vietnam, we think we do because we have these really powerful images. And the French, I think, when it comes to their period of colonialism, if it's remembered at all, it tends to be remembered as a sort of romantic period with, you know, very nostalgic black and white photographs of the French looking nice in their white linen suits and the Vietnamese looking subservient, playing their role as servants. And this covers up a really heinous period of French colonization that the Vietnamese who rebelled against it described as slavery. You know, the colonizer never comes to another country and says, I'm here to rape and pillage you. You know, they come in and say, well, I'm here to bring you civilization. And then I'll rape and pillage you as well. But the veneer of civilization is what justifies all of the exploitation that is a part of colonization. But that gap between what the colonizer says about the civilizing mission and what the colonizer actually does is a source of rage. And I wanted to bring all that out. But it's also a source of humor with enough distance. And so there's a lot of satire deployed in these books as well. And that those two emotions go hand in hand. And I think they're driven by a common motivation on my part to sort of illuminate how power works and how seductive it is, because I'm the first one to admit that I'm mentally colonized. It's like I may reject colonization at an intellectual level and a political level, but I get, you know, easily seduced by the French.
So in what way have they mentally colonized you, and what do you want to get rid of? What do you actually want to clean out of your mind and have a clear view of?
like everybody else, I love the tourist version of Paris, for example. I get weak in the knees when I see a baguette or when I see the Eiffel Tower or when French people say, where's the bathroom in French? You know, I mean, like the stupid stuff like that is a sign that I give the French a lot of allowances simply because of who they are. And who they are is or was an imperial power. And I think whether we're talking about the British, the French, or the Americans, and so many other colonial powers that I mentioned in the book, they have an advantage. Because power equals or makes it easier to seduce. And so one of the contradictions of colonization and its aftermath is that even if we are angry at the colonizer, we're also forced to live with the colonizer constantly through their presence, their cultural and political presence in our lives. And that inevitably produces a distortion. And we should be able to make fun of ourselves. And so, you know, our narrator, the sympathizer, let's just be very clear. You know, he constantly punches up at the powerful, which is what satire should do. But ultimately, he's always the butt of his own joke. And hopefully that makes him vulnerable and someone we can identify with.
How big a joke is it to call him Vaudan?
So he's nameless. He's certainly nameless in the first novel, known only by these things like being called the captain, which is his military rank, and being called a bastard, which is the epithet that's applied to him. And things have changed in the committed. In the committed, he's no longer just a bastard. He's the crazy bastard, as other people call him, because he's been through a lot. But in order to get into France, he has to have a passport, and so he has to have a name. And the name he gives himself is Voyang, which is, as we discover in the book, simply means no name or anonymous. And so he thinks he's playing a joke on the French bureaucracy because he says, well, you think you're getting a name from me, but it's really no name at all. And then, of course, he tells us that the reason why he's given himself this name is that when you go to Vietnam in the aftermath of this war that killed millions of people, and you see all over the place these military cemeteries devoted to the victorious Vietnamese dead, what you see oftentimes are gravestones with Vo Yang on them, which means that hundreds of thousands, or at least tens of thousands, of North Vietnamese soldiers died anonymously. And that's a real tragedy, obviously. Mm. And so it is a joke on the French bureaucracy, but ultimately it's an extremely painful joke as well.
The part that you send, the part of Paris that you send Vo Yen to, though, he ends up being a drug dealer here and dealing in all sorts of, with all sorts of nefarious beings and characters where he finds himself. It isn't the romantic side of Paris that he's in.
Oh, yes, because I think all of us know the romantic side of Paris. All of us have been exposed to it, again, through the power of French culture. These stereotypes of the romantic French and of beautiful Paris are circulated all over the world. So I didn't feel like I needed to situate my character in that milieu. And instead, I wanted him to be in the immigrant quarters of Paris because I spend time there. And I think, you know, this is the place where the contradictions of French history and French life are very visible because these immigrant quarters are full of people who basically are not white. And to even bring that up is I think problematic for the French who insist that there's no such thing as race and that if you see whiteness, you're simply being a racist yourself. I mean, that's exactly the kind of conversation that's happening today in France. And so in these immigrant quarters, he's living among other Vietnamese and Chinese people and other Asians, including Cambodians. And he's also, you know, coming into contact with other formerly colonized populations like Algerians, Senegalese, Tunisians. So this was important to put him in this context so that I could bring up these colonial histories that these characters bring with them. The other reason to have him there is because he has to find a way to survive in Paris. And he ends up living with his aunt, who is also mixed French and Vietnamese, but she's of the elite class, and she's an editor for a publishing house, and she hangs out with all these intellectuals and these left-wing politicians. They also are human because they like their hashish, and as it turns out, their drug dealer has disappeared. And when our narrator shows up, he sees an opportunity because he and his best friend Bon have a contact in Paris, the boss, who is this crime lord, and the boss has promised them jobs after they met in the refugee camp. And so our narrator has this brilliant or misguided idea to sell hashish to the intellectuals and the elite and all of that. And that's how the plot gets going. And I wanted to make it into a crime novel because The Sympathizer was a spy novel. I did that because it's very entertaining, that particular genre, and allows me to bring up all kinds of politics and history. But also, as he points out, the drug dealer is simply another kind of capitalist, and it's capitalists who are really the scary types. I mean, drug dealers may harm you individually, but capitalists are the ones who steal and plunder from millions, as he tells us.
And do I pick up that perhaps you agree with him on that point?
Well, I think the sympathizer, if we call him that, Vol Yang, he is certainly an alter ego of mine. He says a lot of things that I do think. Maybe he says some things I don't think. I don't want to give everything away about where I align with the sympathizer. But he's originally a communist spy. You know, he came to revolting against the French through Marxism and communism. And by the end of the sympathizer, he's disabused of the communist revolution. He sees all of its various failings and so on. But he's not disabused of revolution in general. Like, he still believes that we need revolution. The question is, and this is what the committee deals with, what does a revolutionary do when he loses his revolution? So we take that up. But he still, even though he doesn't believe in a communist revolution, I think he is still aware that capitalism has very significant problems, and that capitalism and colonialism are inextricable from each other. And I think we really have to understand that, to understand how, if we live in a capitalist country, the many wonders of capitalism that we may participate in are inextricable from the histories of colonization that brought all this wealth to places like Paris. You know, like, you can enjoy all these romantic, wonderful pleasures of Paris, like visiting the Louvre, for example. That's inseparable from histories of colonial plunder. And likewise, we wouldn't have colonization without capitalism. That colonization is just another form of capitalism that's done in colonized countries. And so he has to be critical of capitalism, given his own colonial origins and his communist influences.
So I guess in some ways, when you write about that particular colonialism that we're speaking about, the French colonization of Vietnam back in the 50s, and you make this reference to capitalism, in as much as you're writing about France 1950s colonization of Vietnam, you're writing about capitalism in 2021, any country in the world that works in the capitalist system.
I don't think things have changed that much. I think that the nakedness of colonization has been shrouded to be a little bit more palatable for people, but the mechanisms of exploitation and marginalization are still there. And this novel is set in 1982. It was really fortuitous to set it during this time, because the novel concludes in 1984 with one photograph in the book. And that photograph is a real photograph of the first immigrant rights march, anti-racism march in Paris, that had mass numbers of Arabs, people of Arab and Algerian and North African descent, black people, and a handful of Vietnamese people. These people would not be in France or in the United States if it hadn't been for colonization that brought them the homeland of France. And in 1982 to now, I think, is not that far either. The very issues that are being raised in early 80s Paris are still resonant today. And so we're still in the long aftermath of colonization, and arguably colonization has not even finished yet.
You do. It's important, because these are very, you know, some of them very weighty ideas and very important ideas. But it's really important that we don't lose the entertainment side of what you're doing in this novel, as indeed you did in The Sympathizer as well. You love having a go at the intellectual elite and their three initialed names, like BFD, the character you have in the book. Maybe explain that philosopher and what was in your mind there.
Yeah. So in The Sympathizer, of course, I mean, you could walk away from The Sympathizer and think, Nguyen is only going to criticize the right wing. And I thought that, in fact, if we go to Paris, it gives me a huge opportunity to satirize the left wing, because there's plenty of things to satirize about the left as well. So every ideology, I think, has its shortcomings once you put real human beings in them, because real human beings are petty and flawed individuals. And I speak as a petty and flawed individual myself. and if you're at least anywhere cognizant of what's happening in contemporary French life, you know, just read the headlines occasionally, you're aware that in the last few years, the French left has had its issues. So, you know, BFD, that character, he is a rosé socialist descended from, you know, a Cabernet communist. And so, you know, he talks constantly about May 1968, this moment of French Revolution, which is very fetishized in the French left-wing imagination. And yet he's still a white guy, and he's still a person of immense privilege. And so it's impossible for him to look at someone like the sympathizer, like Vo Yang, and not condescend to him. So Vo Yang is constantly exposed to the condescension of the French left and of French intellectuals who can't see how much race still plays a role in their perceptions and in their attitudes, especially towards Asians, whom they fetishize and orientalize. And so it was actually fairly easy to compose this composite character of BFD, made up of various kinds of French figures and scandals that I've been aware of.
The other thing that really struck me in the book was in The Sympathizer, we had references, lots of references to Apocalypse Now, and obviously that's a popular cultural representation of the American war in Vietnam. In The Committed, we get a scene with Russian roulette. Immediately, of course, the Deer Hunters sprang to mind. I presume that was there in your mind as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, here's a tip of my hat to my editor, Peter Blackstock, you know, who is always good at pulling me back a little bit. Because in The Sympathizer, I think we deleted a chapter and a half from the Apocalypse Now scenes. He said, you're probably going a little bit too far here. And likewise here with the Russian roulette sequence, it was actually in the first draft much more explicitly about an allusion to the Deer Hunter. There's all these scenes from this movie that are being talked about. That's all gone. So now there's just a Russian roulette sequence, and you have to know that there was this movie called Deer Hunter. That's up to you as a reader. But I continue to try to have fun with popular culture in this book, again, because I think that American popular culture, the reason why it's important is not just because it's American and I'm American, but because Americans have global power. So their pop culture or our pop culture is circulated globally and has impact on everybody, even people who don't like Americans. You know, so one of the ironies of the outcome of the Vietnam War is that a lot of people all over the world thought of the war as a bad war, as an American imperialist war. And then they'll turn around and they'll watch Apocalypse Now. And there's no disjunction between these two things that you might be opposed to America, but still watch American movies that silence Vietnamese people and erase Vietnamese voices. So it's important for me to keep on bringing in these cultural allusions and to make fun of them. And of course, it's also fun for me as a writer to write these kinds of scenes. I think some reviewers have compared the scene not only to The Deer Hunter, but to, you know, Quentin Tarantino and Reservoir Dogs. And I like that. I like the way that my novels, of course I would like them, I wrote them. I like the way that my own novels mix together the high and the low, including lots of allusions to B movies, pulp fiction, crime novels, all that stuff that I grew up on and that I love.
What do you dislike about your own novels?
What do I dislike about my own novels? In The Sympathizer, I set out to try to offend everybody, including Americans. And yet this supposedly very subversive novel won the Pulitzer Prize in the United States. That makes no sense. So I won a bunch of other awards, including in France as well. I guess what I dislike about my own novels is this possibility that maybe they're not that subversive. Maybe they are doing things in a way that is still amenable to dominant culture, colonizing culture, and the like. And that kind of ambivalence or duality, as you said, is a part of the narrator's point of view in these novels. It's also a part of the effects of colonization. It's very difficult to extricate oneself from the effects of colonization, from the effects of racialization. I'm hardly the first writer to experience this dilemma of writing novels that are intended to be deeply critical of colonizing cultures and yet having these novels become celebrated in various ways. You know, you can point to any number of so-called post-colonial writers to whom this has happened, from Salman Rushdie to Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, who have confronted the problems of criticizing the colonizer in their own language, in this case English, and in their own forms, in this case the novel. Well, what else are we supposed to do? what else am I supposed to do? You colonized me. And as the novel makes fairly clear, I think I like Caliban, have no choice but to curse you in your own language.
What a wonderful way to finish up. So great to speak with you. Can't wait until a time comes when you can actually visit us here and talk further about colonisation, because it's a subject that's dear to many people's heart in this country as well. Lovely to speak with you this evening, Viet.
Thanks so much, Sean.
The Committed by Viet Thanh Nguyen is published by Corsair, and Viet will be talking as part of the Kurt International Literary Festival. He'll be with us on Thursday, April 22nd at 5:30 p.m. and you can get full information about booking, etc. on kurch.ie. Carmen Maria Machado has already made her name as a writer of fiction. Her gothic horror-infused short story collection, Her Body and Other Parties, was a finalist for the National Book Award, was the winner of the National Book Critic Circle's John Leonard Prize, and is now being developed into a TV series. She's also the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship Award and is writer-in-residence at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. Now she has written a haunting, timely and incredibly important work of non-fiction called In the Dream House, which is her memoir of surviving an abusive relationship. The book, which has just won the Rathbones Folio Prize, was hailed by the judging panel as a compelling memoir, a striking piece of storytelling and a work of art. The book is notable not just for its striking structure, divided into fragments, each referencing a different literary or cultural genre, but also for detailing abuse within a queer relationship, something that is rarely documented in modern society. If you need this book, she says in her dedication, then it is for you. I'm delighted to have Carmen Maria Machado join us on the programme this evening. It's, I don't know how to describe how moving the book is and how frightening the book is in places, but this starts out, Carmen Maria, as a love story, and as a love story where you think, yes, good old Carmen is in the dream house. She's going to live a dream life and be involved in a dream relationship.
Yes. Little did she know.
Tell us how you found yourself feeling that.
I mean, it was very strange. I mean, I remember the part of the writing the book was hard in a lot of ways, and obviously writing about the bad stuff was really hard, but it was actually strangely challenging to write about the good stuff too. You know, it reminded me, I had to sort of go back to this place that I was in what felt like a past life, you know, a past self that I hadn't accessed in so long. And it was very strange having to like remember what it felt like in the beginning, because it felt amazing. it was very complicated.
And one of the reasons it felt so amazing back at the very start was the absolute and total acceptance of you and seeing you perhaps in a way that others hadn't seen you previous to this.
Yeah, you know, I spent a lot of my life, I mean, for a lot of reasons, I was sort of a late bloomer, and I had never really found my place, sort of, you know, I had never really sort of got a sense of myself, you know, in relationships or in a romantic way. And meeting this person, I remember thinking to myself, oh, this is what I've been waiting for this whole time. You know, this is what everyone says. It's like, you just need to wait for the right person. And it felt faded. I mean, it felt sort of, which sounds so dramatic, but like when one is in one's early 20s, everything is kind of dramatic. So,
and we may well laugh at all of that now, but how quickly did you realize that far from being in a dream house, you were in a nightmare house?
I mean, it's sort of strange because people ask me this a lot, and I feel like the answer, it sort of differs in different ways depending on what you're noticing. So like, you know, I didn't have the language for what I was experiencing until much later, you know, after the relationship was over. And I think that part of what made it so difficult to extract myself was, you know, all bad relationships with abusive dynamics, you know, they're not always like that, because if they were, no one would get into them, right? You know, they're good, and then they get bad, and then they're good again, and there's this sort of cycle. And so, you know, I there are sort of various moments in the book where I talk about like the first time that my ex-girlfriend, I say in the book, you know, she touched me without love, like she grabbed my arm and squeezed it to stop me from saying something. And, you know, that was like a very chilling moment for me. And in retrospect, I think, even though it like feels like it's weird, it feels minor sort of in the scale of things, but it was that first moment where I was like, that doesn't feel correct. And yet I still dated her for, you know, almost a year after that incident. So like, it's a really, it was sort of a strange, like multi-step process that eventually took me, you know, a sort of what I thought of as like a sanctioned reason to get out of the relationship, which was, you know, infidelity, even though that was like very low on the list of terrible things that happened.
Yeah, because the type of physical and emotional abuse that you detail here is truly frightening and truly horrific. But I'm interested in quite early on, I'm not sure if it was close to the particular event you've just described there, but it was an instance of jealousy. There's a lot of jealousy and much of it unfounded type of jealousy involved. At which point, when you, I think you kind of, you were comforting a stranger in a public toilet who needed some help, and your ex-girlfriend turned around, she was very angry about it all, and she said, "You are not allowed to write about this. Don't you ever write about this." And then she uses a few expletives and asks you, "Do you understand what I'm saying?" That, to a writer, what was your, I mean, the shock must have been there in the moment, but as a writer, when you think about what that says, how do you feel?
I mean, it's strange because now looking back on it, I mean, with the sort of the clarity of being, you know, a decade past those events, I'm like, oh, that makes sense. Like, you know, writing was my voice. It was my way of speaking and being in the world. And, you know, I mean, I was just in a very early stages of that when this happened. But, you know, whether instinctually or deliberately, she understood that there was something that needed to be sort of muzzled or shut down. And she found it. And she found any excuse she could to use it. So, I mean, I feel like with this book coming out, I talk a lot about how, like, we sort of romanticize things like jealousy. You know, we say like, oh, like, if, you know, your jealousy just means someone really loves you or cares for you. But of course that's not true, right? Jealousy on that sort of extreme level, that sense of possession, is very like abnormal and not romantic at all. So I feel like it was too early on for me to recognize what it was, and I didn't really have the framework of understanding that. And also had sort of the one way in which I sort of knew how to articulate myself clearly taken away from me.
So
I had agreed.
Yeah, I was going to say, did you obey? Did you just not write about it for a long, long time? Or were you writing in secret? And given the relationship you're in, writing in secret would have been a very frightening thing to do.
So it's weird. I was not writing in a deliberate way. What's very strange is that I was writing other things that later, when I looked back on it, I was like, oh, like, I was sort of sublimating all of my feelings and it was coming out. Like, I remember I wrote a story about a couple in a relationship that had broken up, and I wrote it while I was dating my girlfriend. And then I sort of hit a halfway point and I said, I don't know how this story ends. And then I just sort of put it aside. And then, like, several years later, I picked it up again and realized with horror as I read it that, like, I had written a story about an abusive relationship. Like, that's what I had written, but I had no way of articulating that at the time. So I mostly did not write, except when I was writing and sort of, you know, accidentally writing about the situation I was in. But it wasn't until much later that I actually began sort of consciously writing about what I was experiencing
and moving
or what I had experienced.
Yeah, and moving towards this book that we now have, which is called In the Dream House. Many people have noted on each chapter has a title, Dream House as something or other. And in fact, the one where you're talking about how suddenly you felt, yeah, all my prayers have been answered, is Dream House as Luck of the Draw. You have other ones like Dream House as Bluebeard, Dream House as Appetite. Just explain that structure and what it allowed you to do in the writing of the book.
Yeah, well, at the time when I started to try to write in sort of a deliberate fashion, I was really struggling because everything I wrote was terrible. So I would like write some pages and I would look at them and be like, oh, this is like truly dreadful. And I was really struggling to like have the kind of distance that I needed, I think, to write the book successfully. And I had not sort of come upon the form, as it turns out, of what I actually needed. And I was teaching at this like summer camp for teenagers in the Midwest in the United States. And I was teaching at this camp and I was every day doing these lessons about genre. And I started to just, because I, you know, when I teach, I'm sort of thinking about what I'm saying. And I was suddenly like, I wonder if maybe I need to be thinking about this as like a gothic story or a science fiction story. And so I began to like imagine these genres as these lenses into the experience. And it was just the key that like unlocked the whole project for me. So I went from having like nothing usable to like immediately just writing down, you know, hundreds of ideas, you know, many of which never even got used in the final book, but it just was like this dam that burst. And I suddenly felt capable of writing the book, which before that, I think I was really struggling and I wasn't sure if I was capable of doing
so it. So it's almost as if you thought, right, well, I'll turn this into a story in the following genre. I'll do something with it that'll be a story of that kind. Then you realize, I'm writing a non-fiction book here. I'm not writing fiction. How frightening a moment was that?
I mean, it's very strange because also I was so afraid of nonfiction. And my ex used to say to me that I wasn't a very good essayist, that I wasn't a very good nonfiction writer. And so I had a lot of sort of baggage and anxiety. And I had trained as a fiction writer. Like that was the education I got. That was, you know, mostly my area of expertise. So I did feel very out of my depth, you know, as if I were writing poetry or something, where I was like, I don't know how to do this. Like, am I doing this correctly? And so, you know, it was a very like laborious process, you know, and even when I write fiction, I tend to find it very freeing and very pleasurable, even when the subject is very intense. But this book was very difficult to write. I mean, it really took a lot out of me.
Yeah. I mean, at a technical level, there are differences between writing nonfiction and fiction. But in the reality level, there is these things happened in the nonfiction book, in the fiction book. I'm making these things up. When you're writing, these things happened and they happened to me. How difficult was that?
I mean, it's very hard, you know, especially, I mean, it's funny because I've written, you know, a lot of sexually explicit fiction. Like my fiction is, that is a thing that I'm known for. But it was very strange then to like write it about myself and write it about, you know, and I remember like at some point giving a reading and I was, you know, sitting in front of this massive audience at a bookstore in the US, and I saw a bunch of my former students in the audience, and I had this sudden moment of real fear, and I was like, I'm about to talk about the worst thing that ever happened to me, and I'm about to talk about it as nonfiction, like not as fiction, not with like a novelist's sort of protective sheath. Like I am about to talk about it as a thing that happened to me, and they're like people who know me in this audience, you know, and that was very, very difficult. And I mean, the way that I sort of got through it was I would just talk through my fears. So I was like, it feels weird just talk. And I see my former students and I see like classmates of mine from college and I see people in the audience that, you know, it feels a little strange to talk about it, but yeah, I just sort of had to power through that because it's so much more intimate. It's so much more revealing because with fiction, even if fiction is based on your life, you can just say it's not.
Yeah.
And like no one can tell you otherwise, you know.
Well, we all know that all fiction is autobiographical, but we can say that, and that kind of gets us past actually really answering how it fits into a fictional story. When you were writing this work of nonfiction, then particularly about an abusive queer relationship, any material that you could say, oh well, here's a bit now, here's a bit of archive, or here's a bit of a similar story that somebody else has written about in a queer relationship. Loads of that out there.
Not right. Yeah, I mean that was also sort of the big challenge. Was like, you know, when I started into this project, I thought, well, it'll be probably useful to find some sort of archival material to draw on, to think about, and I just was. And also, I mean, also, I had never written from research before, so I was not an academic, I'm not a historian, you know, I was going into it in this very sort of fresh way, or not fresh, that makes it sound positive. It wasn't positive, it was terrifying. So it was so odd. But yeah, and then I just was very stymied by, like, how little we had sort of recorded. And, you know, when you're, and it's always very hard when you're digging through queer archives because, you know, sometimes the archives are in someone's basement because no university has not been important enough to them to archive it. So like, there's also a lot of sort of just anxiety about, wow, we don't value certain kinds of stories. You know, and it was just, it was a very, like, I mean, the research part was very difficult, just first because I'm just like, that's not my training, but also it was deeply sad. And I was just piecing together these stories from all over.
Just wondering about the reaction you may have had to it. You're talking about burying yourself effectively in front of students, in front of family. What about the ex, who is the other part of the story here? Have you had any reaction from her to the book?
No. It's not really a part of my calculations at all. It was not really important to me.
Yeah, I wondered, do you care about her reaction?
No.
Not at all.
No.
One final thing that I would like you to do for me is tell me some of the ways that I can get pregnant. the list that you give in the book, because I'm going straight home to eat a melon and spinach and a lemon, I think,
right,
as well. What were your favorite mystical ways of getting pregnant?
I know, I feel like I should explain to the people listening that there's a section of the book where I am sort of going through folk tales and fairy tales and figuring out different sort of mystical ways in which people have become pregnant. And oh my goodness, now I'm like looking for the pages in my book, but, yeah, it's like wind, thunder, lightning. Yeah. Eating a series of foods, like a lover looking at you. Yeah, I was really interested in folk tales and fairy tales and how they could inform the book, and was thinking a lot about sort of queer pregnancy in that way. And this sort of thinking about folk tales and fables and things like that. It was like a very interesting little way
and it is a lot of fun, that particular section, and particularly being impregnated by a comet. I'm still trying to work that out.
Yes.
Carmen, lovely to speak with you this evening. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Carmen Maria Machado speaking to us about her book In the Dream House. It's out now in paperback, published by Serpent's Tale. And Carmen will be in conversation with Alexander Chee, another writer known for his challenging the boundaries of genre and structure. And that talk takes place on Friday the 23rd, 8:30 p.m.